Hello.
Hi there. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Trying to get situated here on my desktop here.
You look great.
Well, thank you.
I am going to open this up. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the NDMA Wednesday webinar and open forum discussion. I'm Courtney Koble, the Executive Director of NDMA. And on behalf of NDMA, I thank you all for attending and for your membership commitment to North Dakota Medical Association. Just a reminder, this webinar is being recorded. In COVID news, it's been 2 weeks since we talked. The schools opened up in the last couple weeks, and some North Dakota counties are seeing a rise in cases. I don't think that's necessarily due to schools, but the colleges are opening up as well. Burley is second among counties in the state for active cases. They've got 428 as of today. Morton has 126. Cass is only at 273. And Stark has 207, which is kind of surprising. Grand Forks leads with 468. Six North Dakota counties have no active cases: Adams, Billings, Burke, Grant, Renville, and Sheridan. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator, held a roundtable discussion with Doug Burgum this last weekend and other state and city leaders. We might even have a couple of people on this webinar this evening that were there. Birx had high praise for the state's commitment to testing and robust testing capacities. However, she noted that masks weren't worn everywhere, and so that's something that we could work on as a state. Just today, NDMA participated in a vaccine planning committee. And this is, of course, for the COVID-19 vaccine that's coming out now. It's sounding like late October. It's a committee with the North Dakota Department of Health, and their first meeting was today. They plan to have a plan in place September 18th to go to the Joint Unified Command, and they're going to be basing that on some of the past plans that they've had in place, like for the H1N1. Of course, the high priorities for these vaccines are going to be healthcare professionals, physicians, nurses on the front lines, and then, of course, long-term care workers and residents. And I've got a message from Joan. I'm on. Can you see me? Let me see here. The answer is no. Joan. I don't know.
In as a different person.
Oh, she's in as a different person. Okay.
And I can't do it from my own.
Sure.
Joan.
I looked for Joan.
Right here.
Oh.
Make her a panelist.
All right. Sorry about this, everybody. I got to promote her to panelist. She's in as Joan Q. Connell, so that's why I didn't right away. There she is. Joan Connell, the field medical officer, leads the NDMA COVID Physician Advisory Group. There she is, smiling face, and we'll share the latest COVID-19 update. And of course, we're welcoming our guest presenter and special guest, Noe Mateo. Dr. Mateo received his medical degree from the University of Connecticut. He completed his residency at the University of Michigan and is an infectious disease fellowship at Case Western. Dr. Mateo specializes in infectious diseases, chronic infections, advanced wound care, and travel medicine. He also serves as a North Dakota Department of Health consultant and as a clinical instructor at the University of North Dakota School of Medicine and Health Sciences. Welcome, Dr. Mateo. Very pleased to have you join us today.
My pleasure.
After the presentations, we will have the opportunity for open discussion. Please type your question in the question box or raise your hand. And if necessary, you will be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. So thank you. And I will hand it over to Joan to begin with. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you, and sorry for the confusion.
That's okay.
So it has been another busy week at the North Dakota Department of Health. I think we had to say goodbye to Dr. Stahl, so that was sad, and it leaves one less physician in our leadership. Who played a pretty big role. So uh, In the interim, Dirk Wilkie, who was our chief operating officer, he is a lawyer, is serving in the role of the head of the health department. And I have tried to understand if he is a state health officer, which I think legally he could be, with the three physician assistants like Mylin had, or if he continues to be the chief operating officer and the state health officer position is vacant. Regardless, I know they're looking for a medically trained state health officer. So hopefully that position will be filled soon. So we have been working on optimizing testing resulting, and hopefully most of your experiences in the last week or two have been filled with shorter turnaround times for getting testing results if you're using state-based testing. So I know there's been big improvements in that, but we still have some quirks in the system that need to be figured out. So still working on that. As far as the physician advisory group, we had another lively discussion on Thursday. We talked about testing results. We talked about hospitals in the major cities of North Dakota being pretty full and on divert and such. And critical access hospitals having bed space, but not being comfortable providing care for COVID patients. So we're going to need to be working on capacity. And I've tried to share that with leadership. The other big thing that we spoke about was the impact of schools opening in the hybrid position on nursing homes, because that results in fewer nursing home workers. That could be the case for hospitals as well, but we discussed how nursing home personnel are needing to stay home on those days that their K through five kids are home. So that is a problem that will complicate providing care for our most vulnerable. The other issue that has come up with schools is the sick policy. And we discussed that briefly at the last meeting. Since then, I received one phone call from a fellow pediatrician who was concerned that there's no section in the flow diagram for what if I had symptoms of illness and have a negative test? Can I come back to school before 10 days? And so that had been in our initial flow diagram and somehow it made its way out. So we are putting it back in. So yes, if you have a negative test, you can come back to school when you have been afebrile for at least 24 hours off of antipyretics and your symptoms are improved. So look for that coming because it isn't in the current guidance. There's also been, I work with the school, I call it HURL, Healthy Return to Learning group. And I'm feeling some change in what they feel their priorities are. And I'm feeling the change from we have to figure out these numbers so we can stop kids from spreading COVID and figuring out when we should be closing schools down to kids need learning. They need to be able to learn. And this should be one of the top priorities for our state and our country. So if things have to close to accommodate a lower rate of infection, it's not going to be the schools. So I don't know how the governor feels about that. I know that discussions have been initiated around that, but I haven't been part of that. But I see that becoming maybe a shift in our focus. And hopefully that will result in other things that could be done by a governmental agency to decrease the rate of COVID. So when we talk about those rates, I was asked just today by Renee Mock from Burley Morton, or from Bismarck Burley Public Health, you know, how do you, Courtney talked about Grand Forks has more cases than Bismarck, has more cases than Fargo. So how do we get on the same page given our differences in population? So recently through the HURL group, as well as the Burley Morton Task Force, we asked for some standardization measures in the dashboard. And this week we received the 14-day case rate per 100, or sorry, per 10,000, and the 7-day case rate per 100,000. And the 7-day is a federal standard that's been used to measure transmission levels. And less than 10 is low transmission, 10 to 99 or 100 cases per 100,000 in 7 days is moderate transmission, 100 or more is high transmission. Minnesota, which is what we based our definition of transmission rates, uses the 14-day case rate, less than 10, low, 10 to 49, moderate, 50 and above, high. So if you look on your dashboards and break it down by county, you can see what your county's transmission rate is. You can also see the state transmission rate overall. I did look at those numbers today, but I can't remember them specifically. I think I got a little nervous when I couldn't sign on. So feel free to check that out, and maybe I'll look at it while I'm listening to Dr. Mateo, and then I can report back if you're interested. But I think those things are important to know, because it is clear that it doesn't really matter what color we are, and we may or may not get assistance from governmental forces in regulations that bring down, would help us bring down the case rates. We need to be very active as physicians. People listen to us, and there's a lot of confusion out there over how serious this is. Do masks help? What is a violation of my personal rights? You know, and much of this could be cleared up by the wonderful physician-patient relationships I know that we all have and are privy to. So I'm encouraging you to go the extra mile. And I think that's really important. And then one final thing that happened today or this week is the Department of Human Services Public Health Service has come to town. And I think it's in response to the high rates of coronavirus in our state. USPHS is their acronym. And they are listening and learning and also trying to share some best practices with us. And so the HURL group met with them today, and that was my opportunity to meet them. And they voiced, regulations sometimes help, but sometimes they don't if the public isn't going to abide by them. But what we really need is we need leaders from the community to step up and do the right thing. So I can't ask you enough to take a stand and make it a vocal one and make it a visual one. Today, if you looked at the front page of the paper, the people who were talking about the energy industry, I think, including Senator Hovind, who I love and who I know is an advocate for North Dakota. But unfortunately, in this photo, three male leaders standing really closely together with masks below their faces talking. And we need, you have to understand that everyone's watching, and everyone's watching you as a physician. So you need to role model good behavior like you do for your kids, like you do for your patients. We need to role model good behavior for our citizens in our state. So it's clear what the right thing to do is. And I think that's enough. So if you have any questions, let me know at the end.
Thanks a lot, Joan. We did have a question come up from Dr. Kumar, and he says, please ask Joan to send us an email with the numbers she just told per 100,000. So maybe why Dr. Mateo is talking, you could look at that and send, and we'll make sure we send it out. And just to let everybody know that the updated dashboard is pretty cool, and that you can click on different buttons to get different per state or per county, and just to kind of fool around on the website a little bit, it is pretty easy to negotiate. So
yeah, well, and when we think about responsivity of the North Dakota Department of Health, and I'm not tooting my horn because I've also been complaining a lot. I'm the liaison, remember? They gave us that map of rust versus pink color. But those numbers, like I didn't know what the numbers meant because they're not tied to any standards like I described to you. I haven't found any standards that roll with those numbers. And I didn't know, you know, so what does this level of pink or rust mean? You know, are you saying that's good or bad or indifferent? So my response to that was, okay, well, I know about these two, the 14-day case rate and the 7-day case rate, and somebody has defined that. So can we put that on the dashboard? Because then we know what to do with the information. And within a week of our groups coming together and saying that was on the dashboard for us. So I thought that was a big win for the Department of Health.
Yes. Good job, Joan. All right. Dr. Mateo, I'll hand it over to you and you can tell us what you know.
Thank you. How do I share my screen again? What button do I press here? Share screen
on the bottom where you put there's a green button on my computer it's green
it, yeah
share screen. Can you see that?
So let's see if this works. If I click on this, can everybody see this now? Or
yes, it's work, it's a yes, we can.
Thank okay you. All right, so thanks for inviting me to do this sort of panel discussion. I think for the audience here, you know, I've had to mull over this. It's like the folks who are caring for COVID-19 patients, probably a lot of this will be somewhat redundant. And then there are folks who don't deal with these patients directly. And hopefully I provide some information that's of some use. What you mentioned was the various schools that I've been to, but you know, after college and before medical school, I actually went to the University of Wisconsin, where I got a master's degree in medical microbiology. So my thesis work was in immunology, and I spent a lot of time learning about the basics of immunology. And I learned a lot about host-parasite relationships. And I'll be the first to admit that virology wasn't exactly one of my best subjects in graduate school, but I managed to eke through. So anyways, I'll be talking about inpatient management of COVID-19 disease. And at the outset, in terms of disclosures, I don't have any drug company sponsoring me. I don't have any conflicts of interest. So we'll just dive right in. Let's see, how do I switch the slide here now? There you go. Whoop. So exposure, of course, is through contact, droplet, nuclei, and airborne. A lot of you know all this already. The usual portal of entry is respiratory tract mucosal surfaces. So it's really a matter of what you can do to protect yourself from breathing virus in. Up to 40% of infected individuals can be asymptomatic. And you know, when I heard about that, and this was easily 3 months ago, I said, I don't care what Americans say. I think the Asians have it right. We're all going to need to mask up. And I can't emphasize that message enough. No matter what your political inclination is, this is the reality of the pandemic that we're dealing with. The severity of illness, the risk for hospitalization, and for that matter, mortality and death hinges on a number of prognostic factors. And I'll showing that in one of the five slides that I have total for this talk. Major symptoms include fever, shortness of breath, and cough, but there are a number of other presenting symptoms. Fatigue, a lot has been said about loss of sense of smell and taste, and it, admittedly, it's a minority of patients that come up with that symptom, but it's a telling sort of a feature. There can be diarrheas, muscle aches and pain, sore throat and headaches, and so any combination of these symptoms ought to clue you in that somebody potentially may have been infected. And of course, it helps have the epidemiologic background that there is a potential contact with a sick individual. The pathophysiology of this infection goes through a number of phases, and there's a viremic phase where you have enough viral replication, not only at the point of entry, but within the bloodstream so that you can start having systemic symptoms. There's a pneumonic phase, and that's what we deal with primarily when patients first hit the hospital. They typically come in with what looks like a viral pneumonia. From there can be an extrapulmonary phase. All sorts of other organ systems are involved. Coagulopathy, mainly because the receptors for the virus are found quite nicely in endothelial cells. So you have an endotheliitis, and that's probably what explains a lot of the clotting as well as bleeding tendencies for these patients as they evolve through their hospitalization. And lastly, there's a cytokine storm. And at that point, when people are undergoing cytokine storm, you can expect that they have acute adult respiratory distress syndrome. They're requiring high amounts of oxygen. They're basically ICU level care. And that's the most severe form of the infection. The risk factors on the first bullet point here are sort of just a laundry list of what we've seen over the last few months. Extreme of age, it turns out it, with a lot of the population described in China, male gender was a risk factor. Although when you look at the data a little bit more closely, it's because 90% of Chinese males smoke, whereas only 2% of Chinese females smoke. And that's potentially a confounder right there. If you have blood type A, you're actually in worse off shape. If you have blood type O, that's relatively protective. And if you have blood type B, you're somewhere in between. As far as obesity is concerned, what I'm aware of is that if you have a BMI of greater than 30, then your risk for mortality is 2.5 times the population average. If you have a BMI greater than 40, then your risk factor, your relative risk for mortality is 4 times higher than the population average. Pregnancy is thought to be a risk factor, of course, immunosuppression, and you know the laundry list of comorbidities is listed there. Originally, there was some thought that non-steroidals might be a relatively poor risk factor. What I'm aware of now is that it has no impact on mortality. If you're on non-steroidal, coming into the hospital with COVID-19. However, the jury's still out on whether you'll have more severe disease or not. There's a lot of observational data out there that if you're vitamin D deficient, you'll probably have a bit more of a poor outcome. And the reason why I bring that up is that vitamin D deficiency is actually quite rampant here in the Midwest. Whether you think you get enough sunlight or not, it's still quite prevalent. And there's no harm really in starting some vitamin D supplementation, 1,000 international units, 2,000 international units daily, even for patients who have COVID-19 and are actually being taken care of as an outpatient. The socioeconomic risk factors that have been reported for severe disease and poor outcomes include being a nursing home resident. Of course, that's right up there with extreme age. If you're a minority status, if you're African-American, a non-white Hispanic, if you're Native American, and around here, of course, we have a significant Native American population. These are all risk factors for more severe disease and poor outcome. If you're in a lower economic strata and with poverty, then that's essentially a function of not being able to access the healthcare system as quickly as one ought to. There's some concern that if you have mild disease, especially immunity, is, if only from the antibody response, might be short-lived. On the other hand, the truism with viral infections is that a lot of immunity long-term derives from cell-mediated immune responses. And so that's the feature that we keep in mind. Unfortunately, we don't have a way of testing for cell-mediated immune reactivity. And that's very easily available in clinical labs. So people have speculated maybe that folks who have less severe disease might have had prior coronavirus exposures. And we know this because there are actually four different species of coronaviruses already running around endemic throughout the world. There can be a question about how effective vaccines might be under circumstance. And one of the most heartening reports that I saw a while back was that the Pfizer vaccine actually tested for a cell-mediated immune response, and it had some good reactivity there. And then lastly, it brings up the question of whether these antibody tests that we have already are going to be all that sensitive and specific, again, given the vagaries of the immune response. Okay. You'll have to let me know if any question comes on up over the course of the discussion. I'm not sure I'm able to see it on my screen here.
Okay, sure. We'll wait until we're finished with the presentation. One question has come up if you want to take it right now.
Can you tell me what it is then?
Or sure. Jessica Welder asks, I have recently read about now they are thinking possibly a bradykinin storm versus cytokine storm. Do you have any input to that?
Yeah, so I think, it's been a while since I've actually looked at some of these cytokine, chemokine pathways. But there are all sorts of mediators after the cytokine cascade has been triggered. And so to the extent that you have IL-6 inhibitors, bradykinin inhibitors, all of these are being looked at as well. None of them are ready for prime time. None are actually in clinical use except Actemra, tocilizumab. And so I guess there's going to be utility for those types of agents further down over the course of illness. What I'd like to emphasize in this talk is that, you know, if you can actually initiate interventions early on in the course of hospitalization, you stand a better chance of avoiding serious trouble further down the line. But we can go over that a little bit more later. Let's see what's on the next slide here. Okay, so the deal then, the main point of the slide is what's there on the left in terms of tissue targets. The virus enters cells by binding through the ACE2 inhibitor, as well as the cooperation of a serine protease. That's TMPRSS2, transmembrane serine protease 2. So when these two molecules are brought together on a cell surface, the virus is able to bind, enter the cell, and start initiate its life cycle. The thing then is that especially the serum protease, it starts this a pro-inflammatory cytokine cascade. And the article that I quote there actually has a very nice graphic about all these cytokines that are triggered and activated, and essentially points out that along that pathway, you have a variety of potential targets for intervention, where you can have all sorts of inhibitors and mediators start affecting how well the cascade proceeds. However, it's also true that ACE2 is present in most organs. It's I highlighted there alveolar cells in the lung, enterocytes in the small intestine, endothelial cells, arterial and venous, as well as smooth muscle cells in most organs, cortical neurons and glia. So we're talking about being a multi-system disorder when you have virus affecting all of these cells and all of these various organ systems. You know, my neurology colleagues are starting to tell me that they're seeing a lot of patients now because of consult requests with things like what looked like aseptic meningitis, neuropathies. I told one of my colleagues, well, the last I heard is that COVID-19 is associated with a myasthenia gravis type syndrome. And so that's one end of things. And then the other end of the spectrum is that I recently came across a young woman, a nurse who works here, who got infected, got acutely ill, but now is having lingering problems. And she just described herself as a long hauler. If there's any credibility to a virus causing a chronic fatigue syndrome, this is the closest one that I've seen. And of course, I was there when people were thinking Epstein-Barr caused it 30 years ago. All right, so let's see. I think let's move on. This is my last slide. It's kind of busy. But this is the management of infection in the inpatient setting. The first bullet point, of course, is oxygen. And the more I think about this, the more I think if there was a way to actually provide oxygen to patients with COVID-19 getting hypoxic while an outpatient, you could probably save a lot of hospitalizations. If we just figure out a way to have our insurance companies and Medicare and Medicaid sort of loosen their regulations and restrictions for that sort of therapeutic intervention. A lot of folks, of course, will get somewhat dehydrated. There can be problems with nutrition and alimentation. So essentially, a lot of supportive care when they first come on in. And of course, anti-diarrheals are in there to make sure that if they have loose stools, you can provide that, making sure that they don't have any other serious reasons for developing diarrhea. The second bullet point, of course, is optimizing treatment of comorbidities. You know, make sure their glycemic control is better. If they're on some sort of inhaler for asthma or COPD, you want to optimize that set of medications. The third bullet point is proning. And it turns out that you can recruit more of the lung to exchange oxygen to ventilate better in a prone position versus a supine position. We've known about this for a while now in the intensive care unit setting. What I've been telling my hospitalist colleagues is that if you have a patient who's on the regular floor and they're having trouble with their breathing, you should check to see if they can prone themselves in sort of a voluntary fashion, and that can help avoid further trouble downstream. Earlier on, this was maybe 3-4 months ago, we wound up using antibacterial therapy for folks coming into the hospital, thinking, you know, we can't tell if what they're showing with their symptoms, with their radiography, is a community-acquired pneumonia or a viral pneumonia. The statistic that I read in a recent Journal of American Medical Association article is that when you actually formally check to see the rate of co-infection with bacteria in folks coming into the hospital, it amounts to like 8%. Whereas the usage of things like ceftriaxone and azithromycin, empiric antibacterial therapy, amounted to 70% of the patients coming into the hospital. There's a real mismatch there. So my suggestion to the hospitalists that I work at is to get at the outset a serum procalcitonin. That particular blood test reputedly only goes up with bacterial infections and does not elevate with viral or fungal or mycobacterial infection. You have a patient with elevated serum procalcitonin, feel free to go ahead and start empiric or targeted antibacterial therapy. And of course, if someone's been in the hospital long enough, 5 days, 10 days, 15 days, especially in the ICU, they have a bacterial superinfection at that point. Of course, you're going to proceed with your broad spectrum agents. I mentioned before that the virus can affect endothelial cells. Anticoagulant therapy is important for a variety of reasons. Number one, you have a patient come into the hospital, they're going to be confined to their room. They're not going to be as mobile as you'd like them to be. And immobility, of course, is a risk factor for DVTs. So you want to use some sort of anticoagulant, heparin, a low molecular weight heparin, as a prophylactic agent. What turns out to be the trend for folks with COVID-19 is that the first part of illness, they have more of a tendency to clot, whereas the latter part of the illness, especially by the time they get to the intensive care unit, they have a more of a propensity to bleed. So really monitoring what's going on with these individuals, and in here at Sanford Bismarck, we monitor our D-dimer levels quite closely. We check our prothrombin times quite frequently as well to help guide proper treatment. So a while back, we were thinking hydroxychloroquine would be a suitable antiviral agent. And I think Paul Carson earlier in this series pointed out the numerous clinical trials to say that really is no longer the case. There's plenty of evidence that it has more risk rather than benefit. And it's we haven't used it at all in the last easily 2.5 months or so. What has been made available under emergency use authorization, of course, is remdesivir here in the United States. Favipiravir is actually a Japanese sort of developed antiviral agent, and of course, it's widely used in that part of the world. The initial trial with remdesivir pointed out that instead of being sick for 15 days. If you receive it, you were only sick for 11 days. So the way I think about it, it's sort of like the Tamiflu for COVID-19. For those of you who are familiar with using oseltamivir. Another study came up that said that, you know, there's really no survival benefit in using 10 days of remdesivir versus 5 days. So our routine now is to use remdesivir 200 milligrams IV at the outset, day one, and then 100 milligrams daily IV for the next 4 days. And that's it. It's a 5-day regimen. Unfortunately, the EUA says that you can only use this particular agent while you're an inpatient. And we've had recent concerns about folks, just because we're so darn busy here at Sanford Bismarck, can we get these patients out of here any sooner than 5 days? And I go, well, you can't really have them continue on remdesivir. They actually get discharged before 5 days. Severe limitation in my mind anyways. How about immunomodulators? Well, there's the nice study from the UK, I think it's called a recovery study, where those folks who have a lot of inflammation, and you can tell this by some of the blood tests that we checked, C-reactive protein, a procalcitonin, the D-dimer, the ferritin, all of these blood tests indicate a lot of inflammation going on. The standard regimen that we now go with is dexamethasone 6 milligrams daily for a 10-day course. And of course, that's available orally, so some folks who are going to be able to go home and continue taking that as an oral formulation. A lot of the chatter that I've heard about is revolving around convalescent plasma. That initially nationwide was made available through registrational trials, sort of a clinical trial setting. With the recent EUA, it's now available as a regular prescription. And from my perspective, I haven't had to change the way I order it. The main difference is that apparently there's a difference in how who pays for it and who gets billed. The idea then of convalescent plasma is that initially was thought to be the most helpful thing back in 1918, when the influenza pandemic there couldn't be treated with anything else besides public health maneuvers. Folks who recovered from the Spanish flu wound up having these antibodies, and plasma therapy at that time was made available to folks who were severely ill. So at this point, it's a theoretical construct. There's no randomized clinical trials to say that this is really going to be a highly effective approach. It's a matter of faith at this point that we actually still use it. And it turns out that this particular intervention is probably better. There's data to indicate it's better if you use it earlier in the course of hospitalization rather than later. There's a distinction as to whether you use the first 3 days of hospitalization versus 7 days or later. And so we're going to go ahead at this point, checking to see if the moment the patient hits the door, combining remdesivir and dexamethasone convalescent plasma from the get-go is going to be a lot more effective in shortening length of stay, improving outcomes, and decreasing morbidity and mortality. Of course, I'm not the only one here at Sanford Bismarck Hospital who cares for these patients. These folks are primarily followed by our hospitalists. So I wind up seeing these people initially in consultation when they first hit the door, and then hearing more about them during the course of hospitalization until the time that they actually get severe enough, requiring mechanical intubation, ventilation and intubation, they head on over to the ICU. At that point, I start seeing them a little bit more closely. Once in the ICU, it's the next to last bullet point there. They're probably going to require high flow nasal cannula, BiPAP ventilation, or mechanical ventilation with an endotracheal tube. These are the folks who are at high risk for a cytokine storm. And the IL-6 blood test that we have is the one indicator we track closely to see, because if that starts jumping up, they're requiring more oxygen, they're looking worse off clinically, they're requiring higher PEEP pressures. That's when we pull the trigger on tocilizumab. And again, it's like $5,000 a dose or some crazy figure like that. And so that particular intervention is something that I work with the intensivists to actually proceed with. We've had one patient who we've had to use it twice. That it still didn't result in a very good outcome. We've had a handful of patients for which a second unit of convalescent plasma has been tried. And again, those folks by and large don't do well, but you know, when they're elderly in their 80s, they've got a variety of comorbidities, they're quite obese, you know, the deck is stacked against you. The last bullet point is what I think is kind of interesting, because a lot of folks have relied on artificial intelligence and looking at drug databases and cross-referencing it with molecular studies on what the components and epitopes and antigens of the virus look like, which potential chemical entities might bind the virus at various targets. And so when you have a list of chemicals, some of which turn out to be prescription medications that we're already familiar with, some of these agents potentially are being studied for repurposing, recycling. So I'm aware of that ivermectin, there are a few fans of that, and that's potentially being studied. Colchicine is another agent that's been touted as having activity against viral infection. What I look on favorably is famotidine, because Pepcid is actually available as an outpatient prescription. And I've had a few colleagues who work here at Sanford Bismarck Hospital get sick over the course of work, stay at home because they quarantine, ask me, well, what is it that I can try at home besides, you know, higher doses of vitamin D? I go, yeah, well, you might go ahead and just start taking famotidine. That it ought not to hurt. It is an H2 blocker, as antacid. And we actually have an intensivist here at Sanford Bismarck who removes people from their PPI and uses famotidine in the ICU patient. Now, you know, this may sound like this is what we're doing here now, and this is what works. I can say categorically, there's plenty of room for improvement. None of this is written in stone. It's not even written on paper. You know, the moment you turn the computer off, all of this is gone. The point here is that a year from now, it's a good bet that we're going to look back at all of this and say, really? That's what we did a year ago? And we'll just have a good hearty laugh. So at that point, I'll stop. And, you know, if there are further questions, I'm sure there are folks who are going to have some more hands-on sort of practical day-to-day questions, and we'll open up for discussion.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Mateo. This is excellent presentation. Dr. Kumar asks, if a healthcare worker's child is positive for COVID-19 and is at home, then what is the advice to give for that healthcare worker?
Yeah, that's come up time and time again. I think to the extent that they can quarantine themselves, that would be preferable. But, you know, the point's well taken. If you're a healthcare worker and you happen to be a single parent, that's, and you have young children, that's going to be kind of tough to do. The rule of thumb that I have is that within any given household, if one individual is already infected, it's a good bet at least one other and maybe two other individuals in the same household are infected as well. I mean, I say this because this is what we're seeing with the Native American population that we deal with here. They all sort of tend to live in smaller, crowded, congregate housing settings. You wind up trying to stick with whatever maneuvers you still can. Masking at home, hand washing, hygiene. There's really no good way of doing the proper social distancing that you'd expect for, you know, a larger setting. Now, that being said, one of the very first individuals that I knew of who came down with COVID-19 was the husband of one of my cousins. And he was an emergency room physician. So he knew that he got exposed and got infected. Of course, being a physician, you know, it's like they had a big house. And he managed to stay at the basement apartment. Essentially what I call a mother-in-law suite. But he was there caring for himself, and the rest of the family, his wife, their three young sons, managed to stay in another part of the house. He was there at home taking care of himself until he got to the point where he got so short of breath that he had to be admitted and stayed for a short while receiving supplemental oxygen. But he's recovered. He's back to work as an emergency room physician. No one else in the family got sick. So it's not impossible to sort of find a place, a way to sort of self-isolate yourself. But again, that it's going to require a very specific setup, lots of room, a separate set of facilities, bathroom included, and then somebody else in the household to help, especially if we're talking about preschool children.
Thank you, Dr. Mateo. Dr. Kumar, do you have any following up questions? I unmuted you.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. Feel free to just type your questions in or raise your hand. Dr. Mateo, I am, and maybe this is kind of self-evident, but what I noticed is that, you know, Bismarck, the cases are rising, but it seems like it's a lot of young people. So the hospital isn't full of COVID patients right now, right?
We're close to being full. The point here is that, you know, the folks who are being reported as cases, by and large, if they're in the 20 to 40 range, they're going to do okay.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily going to need to be hospitalized. And, you know, if they're able to quarantine themselves and stay out of circulation for 10 to 14 day course, they're going to do okay. On the other hand, by the time someone is diagnosed COVID-19 positive and has been symptomatic, you know, the peak period of transmissibility, the peak period of being able to transmit the virus is the 2 days before you start noticing symptoms and the next 3 to 4 days afterwards. So if you don't get tested immediately, if you still wind up going to work, hanging out with family, going out with friends, and you're just mildly ill, then it's a good bet that you're going to be transmitting it to other individuals already. And if the individual that sort of contracts infection at that point is one of those risk groups that I mentioned, then they could be in for real trouble. And those are the folks that we'll see in the hospital. So I think the idea that, you know, I'm young, I'm healthy, I can get infected, I'll do fine. That's clearly a very self-centered viewpoint on things. The virus is constructed evolutionarily to spread whenever it can, however it can. So it doesn't take into account your own health. The fact of the matter is you're just a vessel for virus to spread to other people. And that's and when you have that concept of contagion, if that's what you keep in mind, then I think it'll be helpful to sort of start thinking about what you can do to avoid troubling anybody else.
Good advice. Dr. Luke has asked two questions. What is your criteria for admission, and what are your criteria for transfer to referral?
So at our hospital, we don't do transfers for referral. We have folks who require a higher level of care, ICU level care, and those folks we transfer to Sanford Fargo. But folks coming into the hospital, they're going to be evaluated primarily in the emergency room. And we look at the usual criteria. They have symptoms. They have a history of exposure. They already have a prior COVID-19 test done as part of a static screening statewide. Their chest x-ray shows ground glass opacities. Their CAT scan shows the same sort of thing. And they're hypoxemic. I mean, you put all of that together, and you know the pattern that emerges is that that's they have COVID-19. If they're able to manage for themselves, if they're not all that hypoxemic, potentially they can send back home to continue recuperating at home. But the overwhelming majority we see here in this hospital are folks who don't always have the best healthcare for themselves, don't always have the best insurance coverage, don't necessarily see a doctor unless they're deathly ill. And by the time they get to the emergency room, our ED docs say, yeah, you're sick enough and you need to stay. And so that's when I hear about them. It's been a pretty steady 3 to 4 or 5 admissions every day that we're getting here. Unlike 3 months ago when we were hardly getting anybody here, because it turns out everybody who was getting sick was over in Fargo or Grand Forks.
Dr. Luke, do you want to have any follow-up to that? I unmuted you if you'd want to follow up. All right, we will go on to the next question. Dr. Haroff asks, what is the role of COVID antibody testing?
Great question. Right now, antibody testing is useful from an epidemiologic public health perspective because it tells you how much of your population, it gives you another handle on how much of your population has been exposed and infected. So that's one major utility. The other major utility early on, this was a few months ago, was that if you had an individual who may or may not have been admitted, may or may not have been tested PCR with the PCR test, if they now get tested with an antibody and they have antibodies, they potentially can be a donor for convalescent plasma. And that's the other sort of major utility of that test. What I personally have started looking into is to find out if folks who are in the hospital, and we're talking about lengths of stay of anywhere from 10 to 15 to 20 days, if by the time they're in the hospital for that long, or if they were quite symptomatic for at least a week before even coming into the hospital, I'll check an antibody test at that point. And right now, what we have available here at Sanford Bismarck is IgG testing. If the IgG is positive, that tells me a couple of things. Number one, for sure they got infected. Number two, enough time has elapsed for them to develop an IgG response. And in the most recent publication I've seen is that the ideal time to be checking an IgG is 3 to 4 weeks after symptom onset. So if by the time they have a positive IgG, I tell them, I think they have developed an immune response to infection. If clinically they're looking well at that point, and there's really no point in rechecking a PCR because it's going to be positive for 6 to 8 weeks after the initial positive test. So I have a patient in the hospital who's clinically doing better, not requiring as much oxygen, has been in the hospital for long enough. They now have a positive IgG. What I tell the nursing staff, what I tell infection control is they can probably be removed from isolation and moved to a different part of the hospital and be cared for in a standard manner for whatever other problems they may have. So it's a patient placement issue that I'm using it for. Now, is there some other potential utility to it? Probably, until the time comes that we have a vaccine. Once you start vaccinating people, then you're not going to be able to tell if the antibody is a result of the vaccination or natural infection. And that's sort of the natural biologic limitation that we're going to run into.
Thanks, Dr. Mateo. Dr. Haroff, do you have any follow-up to that? All right. Dr. Shield asked this question, and it might be for Dr. Mateo, or maybe Joan, you'd like to chime in too. Dr. Shield asks, should we as a group do something like an open letter to the local papers and try to get a big group of physicians to sign, requesting everyone wear masks, or even urging the governor to require masks indoors?
I think all ideas are good. The other thing I'm so glad you asked that question, Dr. Shield, because I am getting ready to text Renee Mock for our Burley-Morton task force, because I, as a consumer, would appreciate a list of businesses that have their employees wear masks. I've been to two restaurants today, or two places that serve food, and in neither location did anybody have a mask on except for me and my kids. So I would like to have the option of paying money to people who have the same values about masks that I do.
I personally think that an open letter that supports widespread usage of masks for all the circumstances that we would consider necessary and helpful and important is going to be a useful thing to pursue. Again, it's not clear to me how far it's going to go, but I think the sentiment of the medical care workers, healthcare workers, the medical establishment, so to speak, that ought to be made public. I think, you know, it's there are folks out there running around, they get infected, they do fine, they shrug it off, and they say, well, it's just another viral infection. I think as healthcare providers, we need to let people know that we're the ones who see people who get sick. We're the ones who see people coming into the hospital. We're the ones who are taking care of these individuals in their room, isolated from everybody else. And in the process of dying, they can't visit with family. It's just a terrible way to go. And I think we need to say that, you may be able to get through this pandemic without being scathed, but it's a real long haul. And whatever we can do now to try and make things better for all of us, it's not just an impact on the healthcare that we all have, but I mean, if people understand that it has an economic impact, that's the angle I'd emphasize.
Thanks, Dr. Mateo. Dr. Shield, do you have any follow-up? I allowed you to talk.
Yeah, I see that you've unmuted me. Sorry, I don't have a camera. Courtney, might ask you, is it possible, I don't know the logistics, but would it be possible to perhaps have a page that physicians could sign as part of the North Dakota Medical Association that could be developed? And then it wouldn't have to be limited to North Dakota Medical Association, but we could make sure all of our other physician colleagues, perhaps including nurse practitioners, PAs, whatever, try to get a grassroots effort going here to get people to sign it on some kind of a page, and then perhaps sending that to the newspapers, or at least maybe even doing a social media blitz. I'm talking a little beyond my abilities, but I'm looking to you to help. How's that?
Those are all good ideas, Dr. Scheel. Like I was explaining to you a little bit earlier, NDMA did a letter to the editor with the North Dakota Hospital Association, North Dakota Long-Term Care Association, I think the American North Dakota Nurses Association, saying that masks work. And it was published in some of the papers, not Bismarck Tribune. And we did send a mask letter to all the school board presidents. And I know from feedback, I got a call from a legislator who didn't like it. And then I know that our office received a call from somebody that I think one of the school boards sent it to the parents, or maybe just to the parents that were complaining about the masks. And he was trying to argue with us on that masks don't work, and that he knows plenty of doctors that don't support masks. And, you know, I just have to laugh. I didn't talk to him, of course, but I would like to know the names of those people, because every single physician I've ever talked to supports masks. So, Dr. Shield, maybe offline we'll work on in-house here, work on something that we could maybe develop and disseminate. The problem is too, is that we can do a lot advocacy and policy-wise on our own. I don't know if there's any way to quote unquote, change the governor's mind on that, or even local leaders. I know that I read today where the University of North Dakota president was troubled because he had a different mask requirements than the city of Grand Forks. And the reporter pushed him to say, well, do you think Grand Forks should have a mask mandate? And he didn't want to commit to that. He just said he thought they should be the same. So we'll work on that and we'll see what we can put together. And Misty, I'm going to go through these questions here. We're on the hour, but Misty said that at the daycares, at least her daycare, no one wears masks. And this was during the summer and many school age kids were there. But then we had two questions about vaccines. Dr. Clindworth asks Dr. Mateo, what's your take on the vaccine? Will we see it in 2020? How do we reassure patients that safety wasn't compromised in the vaccine development? And then Dr. Mattson also asked about the vaccines.
So the announcements are coming, of course, pretty fast and furious, and sometimes it's difficult to read between the tea leaves, but it's a good bet that we're going to have a vaccine for sure by the end of the year. And well, the more realistic figure in my mind is maybe by the end of January. But there may be a vaccine that's nearly done with phase 3 testing later this fall. And so the question becomes, is it going to be rushed through in terms of usage? Because it's a good bet it's not going to be available with FDA approval. It might be available with emergency use authorization approval. And so to the extent that, they're going to have groups of people line up to get vaccinated, I think we're going to have to look very hard at the efficacy and safety profile of the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, all of these vaccine candidates that are actually being clinical trialed right now. The hurdle that the FDA has set up is that vaccine, whatever comes out, has to be at least 50% effective. I mean, that's essentially on par with what we insist for influenza vaccination. And I have to think that over the next 12 months, we're going to have not only one, but potentially two and three vaccines available. What's already been released is how these vaccines are going to be needing to be stored, minus 70, minus 80 degree freezers, minus 20 degree freezers. They're going to be in batches. So the moment you thaw one out, you're going to need to have 100 people lined up immediately to get vaccinated. And probably the likely regimen will require two shots, a primer and a boost about a month apart. So my take on it is that the folks who wind up getting vaccinated with the first preparation will have the advantage of having some immunity very early on. on the other hand, it's going to be an open question as to how safe it's going to be, because phase 3 trials, as a rule, only test a few thousand people. That's the most that, a lot of these vaccine companies will do. So if you have a side effect from a vaccine that only comes up in 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000 people, you're not going to see it, any of that, until you have much more widespread vaccination of a whole population. The case in point I like to keep in mind is that, we thought smallpox vaccine was like the safest thing. And, a few years ago when President Bush decided healthcare workers as part of phase 1 needed to be vaccinated again against smallpox, I lined up to get my third shot of smallpox vaccine. And I said, well, no big deal. Until one of my colleagues at Regents Hospital reported myocarditis type symptoms. That side effect came up in 1 out of 100,000 people vaccinated with smallpox. And, the guy was young and healthy and survived, but I said, myocarditis from a vaccine, that's nothing to laugh at. That's nothing to sort of poo-poo. So I have to think then that the first vaccine, it's going to be out, it's going to be widely used. I mean, that's just going to be pushed out there. How about the second vaccine? Well, it's a good bet that the second vaccine will probably be a little bit more effective and maybe a little bit more safe by another 5 to 10%. So if you actually wait until you get the second or third vaccine, the advantage there is that you're probably getting a better product. But then you're risking potentially being infected before you get vaccinated. My perspective is that if you're a healthcare worker and if you're on the front line of seeing these folks, I have to think that maybe you'll be getting vaccinated the first time with the first preparation, the second time with the second preparation, and maybe even a third time. Because maybe a third vaccine candidate out there will have like a 70% protective effect with a superb and outstanding safety profile. So we're going to have to look at this very carefully. It's a, years ago when the U.S. Army, those soldiers were being told that they needed to get anthrax vaccination, there was a significant pushback because that vaccine was really harsh. It had a lot of side effects. And even 20-year-old kids that were in the peak of health were having all sorts of trouble with side effects. The government stepped back. They no longer insisted that everybody in the Army get vaccinated against anthrax. They did resume vaccination, but then it became more of a voluntary process.
Dr. Luke asks, or kind of a follow-up to your comments, Dr. Mateo, is how can one make a statement about the safety and efficacy before the phase three trials are done and analyzed?
Well, a lot of these trials, of course, will have interim analyses. When you're talking about the trial being designed so that, you know, 5,000 people are needed to sort of get an answer, by the time you reach 2,500 people in the trial, you may have a partial answer. And by partial answer, meaning if you look at those vaccinated versus those getting placebo and you see a protective effect, just how big is that protective effect? If it's protection by a few percentage points, you say, no, this trial really ought to proceed and continue and get the number of people that are supposed to be enrolled. On the other hand, by the time 2,500 people have been enrolled and you compare the treatment group versus the control group, and the difference is like a 90% difference. I mean, if it's that kind of black and white, you might be able to say, we have enough information here to say that this vaccine will work, it will be safe, and there's an opportunity to approve it ahead of the formal timetable. So that's a possibility that, yeah. You know, we've seen that sort of instance before with drug development. And, you know, it's not clear to me that it's a common thing that we see with vaccine development, because it's a slightly a different infrastructure for clinical trials and the timetable and the review process. But, you know, it's like everything else. Nowadays, it's all being accelerated. You know, of course, the people who believe in conspiracies will say, well, it's all politically motivated, but I'm not going to go there, so.
Not today.
No.
We'll finish up with a comment from Dr. Anderson, Misty Anderson. She says, this is kind of a comment for Joan. If these facilities, daycares, are regulated by the state, can't we encourage daycares to use masks for their staff and older children? Misty's daycare was closed due to having three staff who were positive for COVID.
Absolutely. And I think Dr. Shield shared with me earlier today the policy for the Department of Human Services. So let me take a look at that. Wearing masks and goggles or face shields when out of individual offices if you work at DHS. Wanting no contact less than 6 feet for more than 15 minutes total in a given day. So yeah, so I think if daycares are an extension of the Department of Human Services, which they are, if they're licensed, then that would be a reasonable request. So I will be happy to forward that on to Chris Jones.
Well, that's an interesting development. Misty, do you have any comments?
No, thank you. My boys are out of daycare now. They just needed it for the last 2 weeks of summer when my husband went back to work. But yeah, they're missing the first week of school. So
yeah.
Convenience. And they were wearing masks. They were the only kids there wearing masks. But so hopefully they don't get sick. But I mean, I know they still need to quarantine, but.
Right. But yeah, it's hard. And I guess that's, you know, Kirsten Baszler keeps sharing this letter she received from a football player who attends a high school in North Dakota who said, actually a Mandan High School football player, because he said, while we were playing our game on Friday night where my friends couldn't attend because I could only have my two parents there, we kept hearing the sound of the speedway, which is located near our football field, and it was packed with 1,500 adults watching cars racing, and somehow this just doesn't seem fair. So I think in the last couple of days, my head has really been spun around by, we need to be closing these schools down. Oh my gosh, too. Yeah, something needs to give, but why is it our schools? And why is it our children always? So I think Schools have gone a long way in mask mandates, at least in our community, of Burley and Morton counties. This should be extended to daycare, but also we need adults to be responsible.
Couldn't agree with you more, Joan. Dr. Kumar, you had your hand up.
Yes, I would support Dr. Shields' initiative of writing a letter, because we are not right in our assertion that all physicians are favoring mask. There is a politician surgeon who actually was advising people not to go to Menards because they were asking mask, and he was directing them to another hardware store. So something in the press that shows unity amongst physicians would go a long way in supporting our mission of universal masking. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kumar. All right, I think we're going to wrap this up. Thanks again to you, Dr. Mateo, and to you, Joan Connell. Again, excellent presentation as usual. Somebody just raised their hand, that was Dr. Kumar. We took care of you. So, all right, thanks everybody. Have a great night and stay tuned. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
Night.
Thank you, everyone.
Awesome. You typed a question.